Sometimes the postpartum period is more like a horror novel than most mothers would like to admit.
So yeah, I think the lack of sleep, again, when we talk about like a horror novel where you're not sure what's up and what's down and you feel like you're in this new sort of scary space, it really, like, there's a lot of horror in that postpartum period.
That's Julia Fine. We talk with her about her genre-bending novel, The Upstairs House. It's about a new mother's postpartum depression and her obsession with the author of Goodnight Moon. Then best-selling legal thriller novelist Lisa Scottolini tells us about her first foray into writing historical fiction.
You plumb your emotionality, and you have to put the real feelings on the paper, even though you're a little embarrassed about that. Maybe you don't even want to remember that. But you have to put it on the page because the reader, when you write it, and Philip Roth taught me this, if you write it the truth, it has a ring to it. People feel it at soul level, and you have to do that for every one of the characters. Whatever their emotional truth is, you go there.
Julia Fine, welcome to Writer's Voice. Her new novel, Eternal, is about a love triangle between three young friends in Rome during Mussolini's fascist regime. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on the station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. New motherhood is supposed to be a period of blissful nesting with your newborn. But for many mothers, it's a shock. That was true for Julia Fine when she gave birth to her first child. She fell into postpartum depression without even fully understanding what it was or why she felt so bad. Her new novel, The Upstairs House, emerged out of her experience. It's a provocative meditation on new motherhood, a genre-bending story of how a postpartum woman's psychological unraveling becomes intertwined with the ghostly appearance of children's book writer Margaret Wise Brown. Like New Motherhood itself, The Upstairs House questions what is real and what is not. In addition to The Upstairs House, Julia Fine is the author of What Should Be Wild, which was shortlisted for the Bram Stoker Superior First Novel Award and the Chicago Review of Books Award. She teaches writing in Chicago.
Thank you so much for having me.
I love this novel, The Upstairs House, and this is in spite of the fact that I wasn't sure for quite a long time whether it was going to turn into a horror story.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's psychological horror. I don't know that if you're someone who tends to read horror novels and you pick this book up, I feel you might be disappointed with the label horror, but I think a lot of the elements of sort of horror in general are present in just being a new parent with a new baby. And so I tried to really channel that. So I think even if there's no, sort of the typical horror trope at the end, I think there's definitely horror aspects to it.
Yes, there are. And I'm very sensitive to, I mean, I get immersed in books and in movies. So I eschew horror movies, but this book was really quite wonderful. And it begins as one book and then it becomes two books. And then I kind of felt like it actually became a third book, like nesting Matryoshka dolls. It's a story of a woman, Megan Weiler, who's just given birth to a little girl, Clara. And Megan is struggling with postpartum depression. Her thesis, which she's still trying to work on, is on Margaret Wise Brown, who is the author of Goodnight Moon and The Runaway Bunny, two of my favorite books in the whole world. But it's also a novel it's also a historical novel, and it's a ghost story. So it sounds very complicated, but it's really not. Why this nesting doll of stories?
So I think there are two main reasons. The first is sort of an obvious one, which is that I was very interested in Margaret Wise Brown. And I had read, like you, I had read her books. I loved Runaway Bunny and Goodnight Moon. I have a few of the deeper cuts, like The Noisy Book or Little for Family as well. And I was just very curious about who had written them. And as soon as I learned her story, I sort of felt like, oh, this needs to be a novel, but also it felt like such recent history and these were real people. And so to write sort of a fully historical novel about the life of Margaret Wise Brown, at that point, I might as well write a biography. So I knew that if I wanted to write about her and I wanted to write about her life, I was going to need to find another way in. So necessarily it would have to be almost two books in one. And then the way in that I found was this postpartum, like immediately postpartum woman. The book opens. She's just given birth to her first child, like minutes ago. It starts with her in the hospital and then progresses from there. And I was very interested in the way when you have a baby, your identity, you know, you become a mother, obviously, immediately just by virtue of having had a baby, you just aren't necessarily a mother. But I think sort of taking on the role of becoming a mother is a much slower process. And so I really wanted the book to follow Megan, the protagonist's journey as she mentally comes to terms with what her life looks like now that she has a baby. And she is a PhD candidate and has sort of had to set aside her work. And so there's the person that she was when she began her PhD, and her dissertation is excerpted in the book. And you watch sort of as the role of mother and this sort of new life sort of seeps into who she had been in the past. And so her PhD dissertation sort of morphs from a more typical dissertation about modernist children's literature to something a little more fantastic that sort of mirrors emotionally where she is in sort of how she is transforming. So in a way, it's sort of she and her baby are haunted, but her work is also haunted and her sort of future and her sense of identity is haunted by Margaret Wise Brown.
So now this starts with Megan noticing a turquoise door that is in the stairwell above her condo. Tell us about this door and what she finds on the other side.
So Megan, when she gets home from the hospital, she has her new baby and she is uncomfortable and surprised at her postpartum body and just sort of how foreign she feels to herself. And she starts to hear these knocking sounds that she attributes to their neighbor, and her husband can't hear them and insists that, you know, there's no way it could be the neighbor. And when she finally does go explore the sounds, she finds sort of a door nestled into a space where logically there could be no door. And behind that is the author, Margaret Wise Brown, who is the knocking sounds are she is building a house for her lover, Michael Strange, who was Margaret Wise Brown's real life lover, who she actually did build a house for. She wanted to build sort of a vacation home in Maine for Michael Strange. And so Megan sort of comes upon Margaret and becomes sort of entangled in this lover's quarrel, this very intense relationship between Michael Strange, who was an actress and sort of an avant-garde. She was a poet. She was a bit of a dilettante, but she also was... She's really interesting because she both was very impressive, but also sort of her art hasn't really withstood the test of time. And even in her own time, she was respected, I think, more for just her charisma and the forcefulness of her personality and the fact that she could get things done sort of in the world of theater and art because she had connections and she had money. And so she contrasts sort of with Margaret, who was very talented. And they sort of have an ongoing battle, which is based on their real life battle of sort of whose work is going to stand the test of time, whether or not writing for children is sort of the equivalent in prestige and sort of power as writing for adults and sort of a variety of other sort of issues in their relationship that Megan then becomes entangled in.
And of course, we all know how that turned out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I clearly... it's interesting because obviously Margaret Wise Brown, you know, everyone, if you haven't heard of her by name, you've at least heard of Goodnight Moon, even if you haven't read it. And most people have read it. It's one of the best, it might be the best-selling children's book sort of internationally. But in her day, partially because she was in this relationship with a woman who was in, and she was a toxic relationship. It was, I mean, I think that they were both abusive toward each other, but definitely the record of Michael Strange is that she was not kind to Margaret about her work. And so Margaret had, I think she might have otherwise also still had, even without Michael, she would have had self-esteem issues, but because of this relationship, she had major issues sort of where she second-guessed herself and her talent and the importance and purpose of her work, which is quite sad when you think about sort of the way in her time it was received well, but she could never know, you know, that she'd go on to be the best-selling children's author ever.
Right. Yeah. And talking about toxic relationships, I mean, this is not just the story of Megan becoming a mother, but it's really a story of relationships to mothers. The opening scene, Megan has just given birth and her mother is in the hospital room with her. And also you could almost say that Margaret Wise Brown's relationship to Michael Strange was one of a kind of daughter to a kind of mother. So orient us to these different strands of mother relationships in this wonderful novel, The Upstairs House.
Yeah, I think it's definitely, you sort of hit upon this mentor-mentee relationship between Margaret Wise Brown and Michael Strange was one of Margaret's biographers, Leonard Marcus, who has a really wonderful biography of Margaret called Awakened by the Moon. He sort of theorizes that her relationship to Michael Strange was in part because she didn't have a very good relationship with her mother. And she was looking for sort of something she wasn't getting from her own mother. And so Margaret then sort of had a series of mentor-mentee relationships with older women. So that partially inspired sort of my interest in motherhood, both to young children and adult children. But also I'm very interested in the way that women sort of, the way that we pass down sort of our own experiences to our children, and the way sort of daughters inherit their mother's trauma or inherit their mother's coping skills, how you parent when your parent has not necessarily provided the best example for you. I mean, I'm interested in women's lives in general. I tend to gravitate toward writing about relationships between women and the way that women sort of negotiate their place in society. And I think it, in writing about someone having a new baby, it sort of seemed logical to me that I would also be examining her relationship with her mother and sort of what motherhood means in general.
Right, especially since she didn't have such a great model.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you mentioned in the afterword to this novel that you went through some postpartum depression, and this novel is very much focused around postpartum depression.
Yeah. So it's definitely about, it's very clearly a novel about postpartum mood disorders, which we talk about more than we did, you know, 10 years ago, but we still don't speak about enough. And I actually, so when my son was born in 2017 and I felt down, but I sort of felt like, oh, you know, I should suck it up. I told myself I didn't have postpartum depression, and I think it's because of the terminology that women are given. This idea of baby blues sort of is so patronizing, and you know, you sort of write off what you're actually feeling, because when you call something baby blues, it sounds less serious and it sounds like something you should be able to get over by yourself. So even while writing this book, I sort of had convinced myself that I had not had postpartum depression, that I had had a tough time with the transition from, you know, not being a mother to suddenly having someone totally dependent on me. And then my daughter was born this past year, and emotionally it was such a different experience. And it had me, I sort of reflecting back, it's pretty clear, oh, I definitely had some PPD. A lot of the women around me have experienced PPD, even if they're not calling it by name. And it felt really important to me. I had already started to write this book about sort of that transition into the role of motherhood and how difficult it can be emotionally and how postpartum mood disorders can manifest. But it became even clearer to me upon having a second baby and not experiencing those feelings, sort of that the label of baby blues had been kind of damaging for me, and I probably had experienced some sort of PPD.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with novelist Julia Fine about her latest novel, The Upstairs House. And you say also that your experience with your first child was traumatic and isolating. And that's something one also really feels about this character, Megan. You know, she's experiencing these relationships with these two ghosts. The nature of them as ghosts is not totally clear, but nobody else can see them. So talk about the isolation that you felt and how that informed you writing this character of Megan.
I was one of the first of my close friends to have a kid. And the first of my family as well, my immediate family. And I think I had been very prepared for pregnancy because we talk a lot about pregnancy. There's a lot of depictions of pregnancy and sort of how difficult it can be in media, in literature, where people talk about, you know, your ankles swell or you have indigestion or you can't sleep, whatever it is with pregnancy. But I had not really seen that same honesty reflected in the media I was consuming about the postpartum experience. And so when I had my son, I was the only one in my immediate circle with a small child, which in itself is just very isolating because, you know, you can't go out to dinner the way that you used to. And when, even when someone comes over, you know, your focus is on the baby, whereas they can go to the farmer's market or for a walk without being strapped to a child. And so there was that, but I think I also had, I was expecting the postpartum period to be sort of cozy and, you know, nesting, and my husband had a nice paternity leave. And so we would be also, you know, happy and cozy together. And it was just so much more difficult than I was prepared for in terms of the amount of sleep I was getting, how much my body would need to recover from labor. You know, nursing was more difficult than anticipated. The baby wouldn't sleep, or the baby, you know, what, you can't let the baby sleep because you're supposed to feed a new baby every 2 hours around the clock. So nobody is sleeping. And I wasn't prepared for really what that would mean on a visceral level. And so what Megan goes through in this book is sort of something similar, where she isn't really prepared for the mental and physical toll of having a child. And it's something that the more women I talk to, the more that people say, like, yes, that was my experience too. And I think you sort of blot it out because it is kind of traumatic to be awake with a new baby and not know what to do. And you're changing. There's just so much change all at once and you don't really know what's up and what's down and you're exhausted. So I do think some people, you know, as soon as you can move on from that mentally, people say like, oh, let's move on. Now I have an 8-month-old baby and she's delightful and she sleeps and, you know, she doesn't need to nurse 24/7. And so let's just like block that part out. But I feel like the fact that we as a society don't often talk or sort of have not historically talked so much about that immediate postpartum period makes it much harder for new mothers when they're in it to feel like what they're experiencing is normal, which it is, and to sort of allow themselves some of the mixed emotions that are totally normal after having a child. You know, we're expected to just be so happy that the baby's here and it's supposed to be so easy to devote your life to this new child. But we all, you know, were people before we became mothers and have our own work that we are setting aside or trying to juggle in addition to caring for a baby. And I think to acknowledge the difficulty of that transition is really important in all sorts of ways.
Absolutely. And I couldn't help but notice how many times you mentioned sleep and lack thereof, because I remember that well. And also that alone will cause depression.
Oh, yeah. I remember. So actually, I think there's a mention of this in the book. It's Megan's half-sister, who is a teenager, mentions that as like a torture technique, to torture people, they'll let you fall asleep and then wake you up like 25 minutes later. And that's literally what happens when you have a baby who's been nursing for, you know, an hour and a half, and then you're supposed to set an alarm to wake them up to feed them so that they can gain back their birth weight. Like it's not fun. And it's not, I guess bodies were technically designed to do it because that's how babies, you know, that's how babies grow and how we propagate the human race. But it is not a natural, easy transition. So yeah, I think the lack of sleep, again, when we talk about like a horror novel where you're not sure what's up and what's down and you feel like you're in this, this new sort of scary space, it really, like, there's a lot of horror in that postpartum period.
Yeah, no kidding. And there's another theme in this novel, The Upstairs House, and that's anger. You know, throughout there are sentences like, Margaret had let the anger in. Margaret had let Michael in. Who is angry? Michael is angry, but the energy behind the turquoise door is also angry, which is where Margaret Wise Brown is. So talk about this anger as a theme in this and its disruptive effect.
Yeah. So Michael Strange, I've hypothesized sort of that were she to return, she would be very upset and very angry that she has not sort of been given her due as the artist that she thought that she was. You know, having read her poetry and her autobiography and her plays, I am not surprised that she has not really withstood the test of time in terms of being a mid-century writer that we return to. But I think that she thought very highly of herself and her art and everything about her was this sort of put on ego. Michael Strange was a pen name that sort of then just became her identity. And so she had this really well-crafted persona that then has sort of shattered over the years, especially because her claim to fame at this point is as Margaret Wise Brown's lover who sort of got in Margaret's way. And so I sort of could see her being angry about that. And as soon as I knew that she was angry, I sort of realized in writing the book, well, all women, it's hard to not be angry as a woman. And it's funny because the book's publication coincided with, you know, almost a year into a pandemic where women are really bearing the brunt of a lot of the economic and sort of social safety net sort of collapses. And I think, you know, it's hard not to be mad when, you know, like Megan's husband can just go back to work and resume his life and pop in to take care of the baby when he wants to and form whatever relationship he wants to, whereas she has put aside her entire, all of her work in her sort of future and her career. And it's hard not to be angry about that, I think. I think it's frustrating that there isn't more support for new mothers. It's frustrating that, you know, women's work isn't valued in the same way. I guess this book became sort of a channel for all of the ways in which myself and the women around me are just frustrated by the way that society is set up to almost make new motherhood as difficult as it possibly could be, at least in the United States. I suppose that's where it's coming from.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with novelist Julia Fine about her latest novel, The Upstairs House. So there's another theme here, obviously, I guess, if we're talking about new motherhood, and that's need. And I'm just going to read this sentence because it really struck me. Need is an albatross. This is what you wrote in here in the voice of Megan. Need is an albatross. To be needed is to wear the weight of stones across your chest. To be wanted, that is different. To be wanted by a child is the cleanest of desires. So talk about this need versus wanted. And it almost seems as if this marks a shift in Megan's attitude towards her child.
Yeah, I think it definitely does. And I think that's from a part of the book where the baby is sort of emerging from that fourth trimester. Sort of all the baby does is, you know, sleep and cry and eat and doesn't, you know, babies don't really show much of a personality for the first few weeks to months. And I think, you know, I suppose it's nice that a baby wants its mother to eat or to be rocked to sleep. But I think there's something very, very different in sort of like a primal need for something and like a desire. I don't think a need is necessarily a desire and vice versa. So I think like the reward of parenting is when your kid sort of looks at you and recognizes you for you and just wants to cuddle or, you know, wants to tell you something or wants to express their love, which is something that babies can't do at first. So I think that dynamic, you know, it's something that I think you have to be patient and wait for with a new baby. And, you know, you're patient. It takes a few weeks. It takes maybe a few months. But that can feel like a very long time for new parents, during which it can be frustrating to be needed so intensely. And you can feel angry or guilty or, you know, a variety of other things. So there is a moment in which Megan, who has felt frustrated and has felt sort of like no one is seeing her, does suddenly feel like the baby is recognizing her as more than just like a milk machine, which I think is a really important bonding moment between mothers and babies. And I suppose might come earlier for some mothers, but I think it also just comes much later for other mothers. And the more that we show that in fiction and in film and just talk about that, I think the better women will feel if they are waiting for that bond.
And you felt differently with your second child. You didn't have the postpartum depression. Was this because you had less expectations because you were actually expecting things to be a certain way and so it didn't faze you as much, or was there something really different in that transition from, you know, kind of horror to acceptance and love?
I think that, I mean, I definitely think biologically there's just something different in sort of the physical and mental place that you are with each baby. My two pregnancies just felt very different in my body, and my postpartum experiences did too. But my daughter was born during the pandemic, and so we really didn't have, it was my husband and my three-year-old and me and this baby. And the first time around, I had lots of help and a lot of people around, and I still felt very isolated and lonely. And this time around, it was just us, but I felt much mentally much more comfortable with what was happening. And I think part of it is just, you know, the biological, like the brain chemistry of having a baby and how it is different every time. But I do think part of it too is I had already made that transition. I was already a mother. I was already used to having my sleep interrupted. I was used to sort of having my body belong to myself and my child. And so I think that having made that transition previously, it was a lot easier to sort of go back to that first extreme newborn phase, because it is funny. I mean, the things that you experience as a new parent are so heightened and so intense. And I think that a lot of what happens is something that continues throughout parenthood. You know, like my kid, he's almost four now and he'll still come, you know, pull on me and sit on me and just like not, has no, you know, no real sense that like my body doesn't belong to him. And that's something that I think starts with a new baby, but it's so much less prevalent now that he's older. And, you know, obviously he still needs me. Like I still need to be ready to drop what I'm doing to go to him if he needs me, but it's not as often. He's more independent. So it's almost like with new parenthood, you start at like the most intense and the most difficult. And those first few weeks are just like, you know, turned up to 11, and then you deal with that, you cope with that, and it lessens, it gets easier, sort of you're able to come back into yourself. But it's such a drastic shift in those first few weeks. And it is very, very difficult for almost everyone, I think. Even the people who say they're having, you know, a really easy time postpartum, I don't necessarily believe that they're having an easy time, you know?
Now, at the end of the book, there's another sentence that I would just like you to comment on. This is Megan again. In the story of my life, she says, I couldn't say why I was haunted, why I needed these women in this moment, and why they needed me. There is a room, and in it are objects, and I suppose that is enough. Tell us about that sentence, those sentences.
Well, that... It's one of my when I was writing this book, one of my goals, I suppose, was if I were to write Good Night Moon for adults, what would it look like? And one of the criticisms that people have made of Good Night Moon is that it is just a list of objects. And then, you know, you say that they're there and then you say goodnight to them. And that's the whole book. And obviously, Good Night Moon is for children who, you know, when you introduce one, the pattern recognition of saying, you know, of recognizing the cow jumping over the moon and then saying goodnight to the cow jumping over the moon, there's a sense of comfort for children in that pattern recognition. And it, you know, prepares children for sleep, all the things it does for kids. But I also think that there's, for adults, it's also very soothing and there's a lot to it. And Megan's thesis for her dissertation, which is sort of my thesis as well, is that Margaret Wise Brown and a lot of the sort of progressive early educators who were writing in the same tradition as she was, were basically taking modernism and translating that for young children. So if you think about Gertrude Stein or James Joyce or Juno Barnes or sort of these modernist writers who really immerse you in sensory experience and repetitive language, and it's less about sort of logic than it is about the feeling. Margaret Wise Brown was sort of doing that, but for children, and trying to sort of recreate a child's lived experience on the page. And they actually, this is a very long-winded answer to your question, but I promise I'm getting there. So Margaret Wise Brown and her, she worked at the Bank Street School for Children in New York City, and they would test these books on young children and say, you know, is this, they'd read the book to the kids and the kids would say, that's not what a sound a car makes, or that's, you know, that's silly. It should go like this. And so they really were trying to get into a child's head. And so in my examination of Goodnight Moon, I sort of had that in mind, and it felt to me like sort of the meaning of the book is in the existence of the objects and of the things. And that felt to me like something that would really tether somebody who was struggling and who was sort of flailing around trying to find who she had been before she had a baby and trying to sort of make sense of her world, like to be able to find sort of a tether and a comfort in objects in the same way sort of a child does reading Goodnight Moon seemed like a way that Megan might make peace and sort of come to terms with her new circumstances.
Well, that makes sense. You know, she's constructing her new world in a way. Mm-hmm. She's constructing this new room of motherhood.
Yeah.
Well, it is just a terrific novel, The Upstairs House. And Julia Fine, it's been a delight to talk with you about it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Julia Fine, read a sample from The Upstairs House at writersvoice.net. Next up, Lisa Scottolini spins a tale of a love triangle that unfolds in the heart of Rome under the creeping shadow of fascism. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only interviews, book recommendations, and extended versions of our broadcast interviews. Lisa Scottolini is the author of 42 books and counting. She's the best-selling author of courtroom thrillers like Legal Tender, Moment of Truth, and Someone Knows. But her latest book is her first work of historical fiction, and it had been percolating on her back burner ever since, as a college student, she took a seminar with the literary icon Philip Roth. Now, many years later, her novel Eternal is written and published, a gorgeous, spellbinding story about a love triangle that develops in the shadow of Mussolini's fascist Italy. Unfolding over decades, Eternal is a tale of loyalty and loss, family and food, love and war, all set in one of the world's most beautiful cities at its darkest moment. Well, Lisa Scottolini, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
I love this novel, Eternal.
Yay!
And you are a prolific and hugely successful writer of legal thrillers. This is your first historical novel set in Rome during the Mussolini period, just before and then during World War II. But you say in your author's note that this story has been incubating for a very long time.
I have been writing domestic thrillers and legal thrillers for 30 years now, some 33 novels. But I also write nonfiction humor. But I also said to my, this story has been brewing since college, which is I went to in the Jurassic period. But I was lucky enough to take a course with Philip Roth at the University of Pennsylvania. I was an English major there. And there were only 15 kids in the class. It was a year-long course. And it was just amazing. And I learned tons. But what I really learned, one of the things I learned was that he introduced us to the works of Primo Levi, who was an Italian chemist, who was an Italian Jew and was taken by the Nazis and survived Auschwitz and wrote an amazing memoir about it called Survival in Auschwitz. And I didn't know about that. And I wanted to learn more about the Italian Holocaust. Being Italian-American, I was like, why didn't I know about this? And then I kind of learned decades and decades of doing research about a really horrific event that happened in October 1943 in Rome, right in the center of Rome, where I've visited many times and gone there. I'm lucky enough to be published in Italian. I went there with my Italian editor who said, oh, let's go to the Jewish ghetto and have the artichokes. And I didn't know what a really important thing happened there. And I said, I'm going to write about that. And I'm going to turn it into a story and make it come alive. And that is Eternal. It's a novel.
Boy, do you.
Thank you.
It's set, of course, in the Eternal City of Rome. That is at least part of the meaning behind the title.
Right.
With three protagonists at its core, Elisabetta, Marco, and Sandro, three schoolmates, best friends, as the book opens in 1937. Give us a snapshot of each of them.
Well, Elizabeth, it's really a love triangle between them. And as you say, they're three best friends. So it's not the love triangle where the boys are hating on each other. Like, they all love each other. It's almost no win. And I was like, great idea for novel, Lisa. How are you going to get this ending out? You know, I never know the ending. I don't even know how it middle. So I work it through, which is wonderful in a way. And it's very much the reader's journey. So Elisabetta is a, you know, she's smart and she's independent, but she's growing up in a time that's sexist. And she thinks she might want to write, but she's a little nervous about it. She just reads everything. And she falls for these guys. You know, she's like a kind of a tomboy. I gave for her the experience I had. We'll talk about this and basically be right out front about it. Getting your first bra. I remember getting my first bra. What happens to her is what happened to me, which is my mean girls in my class came up to me and said, you need to get a bra on. And you're like mortified. And she's struggling with that because it's really a question of identity. What is a woman? That's what you're kind of writing about. And then there's Marco, who she falls for, her best friend. And he's gorgeous and he's athletic and he's strong. And he has what's called sprezzatura in Italian. He's effortlessly magnetic and charismatic, but he has a secret. And his secret is he can't read. Modern readers will know he has dyslexia. But imagine being dyslexic in 1930s Rome before anybody knows what that is. You just feel stupid. And that's how he feels. And his best friend is Sandro, who is the really smart and lovely, great listening ear of a person. And he cares about them both and he loves them both. And he happens to be Jewish. So he's an Italian Jew living in the ghetto. And they all three, as it's called, that's not a derogatory term that I made up. And they all three come to be best of friends and kind of fall in love with each other. So Elisabetta's decision is, who will I be with? Who will be my first kiss? And as they grow up, because this novel, unlike my normal thriller, which takes 3 days to happen, happens over 20 years. You know, Hemingway says, write drunk, edit sober. I don't write drunk, but I definitely take it down. Like my writing, my first draft is everything I know and everything these characters do. In the case of Eternal, it was 1,000-page first draft, which is insane. And then I got it down to a normal length novel by just taking out everything except the most important parts. I said to myself, you know, you still know how to pace. You're a thriller writer. So write historical fiction at the pace of a thriller. And that's what I think Eternal is. I hope anyway.
Yeah, it certainly is. And it has a huge amount of history in there. But before we get to some of the history.
Sure.
Yeah, yeah, it certainly is. And it has a huge amount of history in there. But before we get to some of the history, you know, you just said that love triangle, and they all love each other so much, and that love endures. That's a very tricky thing to write. I just wonder how you negotiated the emotional shoals of that particular, you know, how to preserve that friendship, that love that is eternal.
Well, the thing is, and thank you for saying that. I think what you really have to do, I tell you what I did. You know, you really have to plumb the depths of your psyche, honestly. Now, that sounds scary, but I want to encourage everyone who wants to write listening to this. What you have to write is emotionally true. Like, I tell the story about the bra, but the bra is only the physical manifestation, and it's sort of a triggering. I can remember what that was like. I remember that. And I remember getting the bra. Now, Elizabeth in this novel has a pretty bad mother in a way. I had a wonderful mother. My mother adored me, so did my dad. I was the luckiest kid in the world. And I remember when I got my first bra, my mom took me out for apple pie at Horn and Hardart, a place that doesn't exist anymore. But you have to, what I'm trying to say is you plumb your emotionality and you have to put the real feelings on the paper, even though you're a little embarrassed about that. Maybe you don't even want to remember that. But you have to put it on the page because the reader, when you write it, and Philip Roth taught me this, if you write it the truth, it has a ring to it. People feel it at soul level. And you have to do that for every one of the characters. Whatever their emotional truth is, you go there. And of course, the emotional truth changes over time, as does identity. They're all trying to figure out who I am. Who am I? And you know, Marco, for example, cleaves to fascism because it says to him, no, you're not dumb. You're Roman. Romans are special. We're the glory that was Rome, that ultra-nationalist pride that Mussolini instilled in Romans. You know, people say Mussolini made the trains run on time. That isn't actually what he did. That was not his appeal. His appeal was he said, you're special. And as soon as you decide you're special, then you're more special than everybody else. And it's a great source of self-esteem for Marco. And that's why when it comes to, you know, it was so interesting when you look at the times then, because Jews were not discriminated against. Jews were assimilated against in Rome of 1930s. The mayor of Rome was Jewish. So that Jews joined the fascist party in the same proportion as Gentile Italians. So that when the fascist party in the beginning was not anti-Semitic at all, the Jews rose up in the ranks. And when Mussolini finally decides to join forces with Hitler, who copied him, by the way, and not the other way around, in many respects, like with respect to the youth groups, the Jews of Italy were doubly betrayed as he enacts these fascist laws that are anti-Semitic. And they take away Jews' property and right to profession, strips them of fascist party membership. And Sandro's father, a devout fascist and also a devout Jew, says, who am I? Who am I if I'm not Italian? Because ultimately, the laws strip away his Italian citizenship. Well, who are you if you're not American? Who are you if you're not an Eagles fan? Who are you if you're not a Democrat or a Republican? What are the labels we apply to ourselves? How true are they? And how do they change over time? That's a question we all ask. And we will ask throughout our own personal history. This is a lot about the history of families, and all three families struggle during this time with this question. That's at the heart of this book.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Lisa Scottolini about her newest novel, Eternal. It also has a lot of salience to us today, I found, because you show how people are struggling really with the transformation of Italy. I mean, it does start under Mussolini, but you get a sense of what it was before. You know, many of the characters in the book are quite critical of Mussolini. And then the whole transition, you know, the growth of fascism, I mean, literally fascism, we get the word from Mussolini's Italy itself.
Right.
Were you thinking about the parallels to America today and even Europe and the world?
No, because I was thinking about Dante. And Dante has a great quote, which I'll paraphrase. I should look it up so I quote it better. But it's the idea is this, that it's in Inferno. And it's that there's no greater sorrow than to remember how happy you were in a bad time. And that's what I wanted to bring to this book. That real poignance of, you know, and Italy is such a, being Italian American, you know, so I'm so swept up in the food and the spaghetti and the fish and the artichokes and the music and the scenery of Rome, all the stuff that is so, we think of as so charming and so Italian. I wanted the reader to be in Italy in every page and never forget where they were, you know, so that it couldn't happen any other place. Because when you tell it specifically, that enables people to decide for themselves whether it's resonant to this time. You know, and so when I made my research trips to Italy, I made sure I went in October, which was the time of the year when this event happens. And you see the light there and you see the kind of seasonal food they're eating there and the how it's awash in kind of a golden color in autumn. And autumn has itself a bittersweet quality. And that's that Dante-esque quote. I wanted to, so the book starts with food and fun and all of that wonderful stuff that begins to slowly dissipate until you realize that you are starving and you understand that the Nazis, when they finally occupied Rome, weaponized food against the Jews of Rome. When I started to understand that Rome is the seat of Italian Roman Catholicism, but it is also home, the startling fact I learned, to the oldest continuously existing Jewish community in Western civilization. And by the way, that's right across the river. It's a 10-minute walk. The center of Rome is small. In fact, on my website, I'm going to have an interactive map. You can go there and figure it out. In the book itself, I found a map from 1925 Rome, and I said to my beloved publisher, would you mind putting this in the front? And they're like, we'd be delighted to. And I'm like, thank you, Putnam, because you can look at the actual map from the time and see why these three characters were so close, how they're like, they live down the block. I grew up in a city. I grew up in Philadelphia at 9th and Wolf in South Philly. You know, it's my block. It also happens to be a major city, but you don't think of it that way. And so I have a little bit of experience of making the thing that's writ large personal. And that's my job as a writer in Eternal. So it isn't about fascism and what's happening today. It's really about the plight of these three people, what happens to them and their families. And readers are so smart. If you take them along in that journal and you tell it, like Ross said, really honestly and emotionally true, it will resonate for them in ways that you can't, it goes from the inside out. And that's the great thing about books.
Yeah, and that's exactly was my experience because, of course,
wonderful.
I can't, you know, I can't forget the growth of fascism in this country. And to have a look back, and not only a look back, you know, I've been steeped because of my own history in the Second World War. My father was in the Dutch resistance.
Huh.
And so I've studied the rise of fascism in Germany, but fascism in Italy and the history of Italy during World War II is, at least to me, not that well known. And I think that's true for many readers.
Yes, agree.
Talk a little bit about the research you did and what's the thing that was most surprising or, you know, that struck you the most when you did do the research on this book?
Oh, it's so much of it. There's so many little nuggets that I put in the book. You know, there's stories of heroism. There's stories of like the Monsignor at the Vatican who hid Jews inside the Vatican. There's all kinds of things like that. I think what struck me the most, though, is what you started with. Because when I was doing the research, you know, I talked to a lot of experts, one in particular, and an expert in Italian Jewry, and another one who didn't want to be identified. And I said, you know what bothers me about this? And as a former lawyer, I've taught as an adjunct in law school. I believe in justice. I want to see wrongs rectified. And here I was faced with a situation that, you know, was a war crime. And it's not even known. Like you could walk through Rome and not even know it. And then I said to this expert, why was there no Nuremberg? Because in my class, I teach justice and fiction. I taught Nuremberg. The Nuremberg trials is very interesting to me because the laws of Nazi Germany, as were the laws of fascist Italy detailed in the book, were themselves unjust. They perpetuated discrimination. So I said, why was there no Nuremberg in Italy? And this expert said to me, because nobody wanted another Nuremberg. And that's what made me crazy. Because as soon as I heard that, I was like, I do. I want it. I want justice for those victims. And so It's taken me a long time to write it, decades of research and talking to people, and frankly, trying to get the chops as an author. I'm a lot like Elisabetta. I've written 33 novels, but I hope writers are listening to this. I have the same insecurities as everybody else. And I said, Lisa, just do it. You're not getting any younger. And just try your best. And I really feel that that's everyone's writer, every writer's lessons. And that happens whether it's your first novel and you're unpublished, or you've published 33 and 8 memoirs. I mean, I'm supposed to be professional, but I have the same insecurities as everyone else. And I felt like you can get justice, and the actual real names of some of the victims are in this novel. And of course, I sourced all of it, and you can read about that in the back in the acknowledgments. And I also explained what parts are true and what parts aren't, because I think the message is ultimately uplifting. And even though it sounds kind of corny, love does really conquer all in this book. And I really wanted to, you almost work through it like a mathematical proof. And those of you who are writing, you know, I don't know the end. I didn't know which man Elisabetta would choose. I worked through it with the characters. And people were always a little surprised. They go, well, you don't know how it ends? No, I don't even know how it middles. I don't know anything except the premise. I become the characters and live their lives with them. And that's what I hope my reader does too.
Wow, that's wonderful. Now, when you say you have insecurities, give us a little sense of what that means. You know, what might be one insecurity that you have, and how do you deal with it?
Oh, my God. Well, I have a major insecurity of, can I do it? Is this good? Does this make any sense at all? Will anyone? And the thing about writing is we do it, we're solitary, so we don't know. But I'm going to tell you, and writers listening, to flip that. That's the good thing. If it works for you, it works. And that's what you say to yourself as you're going through first draft. I have little sayings. Let me tell you them. I say, get it down, then get it good. Philip Roth, who taught me in that course so many things, he said in an interview, so I don't want you to think I knew him or anything. He just taught us these classes. And it was a small class, so I felt like I knew him, but he was not a very open person with us. For example, he asked us to call him Mr. Roth. We never called him Phil, which we called all our other professors in college. That was let it all hang out days. But he said in an interview once, don't judge it. Don't judge it while you're writing it. That is the mistake everybody makes, including me. As soon as you write the sentence, that's not good. Or worse, I can't write it because it won't be good. So I'm not going to write it. So you sit paralyzed. That's not a good thing. You have to say to yourself, calm down. In Lamont has a wonderful book, Bird by Bird. I'm sure people have read it. I refer to it from time to time, but here's all you need to know about it. Give yourself permission to write, excuse my profanity, a shitty first draft. No one has to see your first draft. No one ever will. Go back to write drunk, edit sober. Put it all down there. Eternal was a 1,000-page manuscript. In my life, I've never done that. I didn't know. I had to change everything I did for this book. I had to write it in a voice that was unique to the time. So I read fiction of the time. I just said, just go for it. Get it down, then get it good. And that's what got me through Eternal. And I will get everyone listening to this through whatever they're writing. I promise them. I promise you all.
And it will be a treat for everyone listening to this to read this wonderful book, this novel, Eternal, Lisa Scatolini. It's been terrific to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Right, perfect. Yes, Ronja Fettuccini. And thank you so much, Francesca. I appreciate this.
Lisa Scatolini. You can find an excerpt from Eternal, where else? At writersvoice.net. It's spring, which puts me in mind of baseball and poetry. April being Poetry Month, of course. Here's a poem by Martina Spada that concerns both poets and baseball. It's called The Fugitive Poets of Fenway Park, read by the poet himself.
The Fugitive Poets of Fenway Park, Boston, Massachusetts, 1948. The Chilean secret police searched everywhere for the poet Neruda, in the dark shafts of mines, in the boxcars of railroad yards, in the sewers of Santiago. The government intended to confiscate his mouth and extract the poems one by one, like bad teeth. But the mines and boxcars and sewers were empty. I know where he was. Neruda was at Fenway Park, burly and bearded in a flat black cap hidden in the kaleidoscope of the bleachers. He sat quietly, chomping a hot dog, when Ted Williams walked to the diamond, slender as my father remembers him, squinting at the pitcher, bat swaying like a memory of trees. The stroke was a pendulum of long muscle and wood, Ted's face tilted up, the home run zooming into the right field grandstand. Then the crowd stood together, cheering for this blasphemer of newsprint, the heretic who would not tip his cap as he towed home plate or grin like a war hero at the sports writers surrounding his locker for a quote. The fugitive poet could not keep silent. Standing on his seat to declaim the ode, erupted in crowd-bewildering Spanish from his mouth, "Praise Ted Williams!" Raising his sword cut from the ash tree, the ball a white planet glowing in the atmosphere of the right field grandstand. "Praise the wall, rising like a great green wave from the green sea of the outfield. Praise the hot dog, pink meat, pork snouts, sawdust, mouse feces, human hair plugging our intestines yet baptized joyfully with mustard. Praise the wobbling drunk, seasick beer in hand, staring at the number on his ticket demanding my seat." Everyone gawked at the man standing on his seat, bellowing poetry in Spanish. Anonymous no longer, Neruda saw the Chilean secret police as they scrambled through the bleachers pointing and shouting, so the poet jumped a guardrail to disappear through a Fenway tunnel, the black cap flying from his head and spinning into center field. This is true. I was there at Fenway on August 7th, 1948. Even if I was born exactly 9 years later, when my father almost named me Theodore.
That was Martín Espada reading his poem The Fugitive Poets of Fenway Park. It's from the CD of his poetry collection, Now the Dead Will Dance the Mambo. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with Hari Ziad about his memoir, Black Boy Out of Time, and with Columbia University neuropsychologist Carl Hart about his book, Drug Use for Grown-Ups. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.